coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Another historic building in Brandy 100 appears on track to get a new lease on life.
Newcastle County has let Ivyside languish for nearly 50 years. What we've got now is definitely a positive sign.
Contributor Larry Nangas has the latest on what's next for the Ivyside Farmhouse. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also delve into what to expect from this year's hurricane season and learn about a new Christiana Care treatment for people suffering from essential tremor and Parkinson's disease. Plus, Arts Playlist offers a look at restoration work coming to the Grand Opera House. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Newcastle County appears poised to halt the demolition by neglect of another historic building in one of its parks. You may recall in May we told you about the Jester Farmhouse in Brandy 100 and its conversion into the home for a community art program. Now it appears the historic Ivyside Farmhouse in Brandy 100 could get a makeover following a similar model. Contributor Larry Nangas has been tracking this story for us and details Ivyside's history and the plans for its new lease on life in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he sat down with me earlier this week to discuss his reporting.
So as we usually do with these preservation stories, let's set the table by giving everyone a look back. Can you give us a quick recap of the Ivyside farmhouse history?
Okay, well, let's start with the location. Ivyside is a farmhouse on the southern edge of Newcastle County's Bechtel Park on Neyman's Road in Brandy 100. And it's not real easy to see. If you've driven by the Bechtel Park many times over the years, and it's surrounded by trees. There's a chain link fence there. It's just not something that stands out. Anyhow, the house was constructed over a period of more than a century. The first portion dates to the 1790s, and at that point, it was on a piece of farmland that actually stretched north over the state line into Pennsylvania. Now, the main portion of the house, which is built primarily with Brandywine granite, was completed in 1853. And the last major addition to the building took place in 1907. Now, Ivyside, the house, is considered an excellent example of the stone dwellings of prosperous Brandywine 100 farmers from the 18th and 19th centuries. And for a good part of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Ivyside was a thriving dairy farm. The county acquired Ivyside as part of what is now known as Bechtel Park, named after the family that last owned the site, in 1976.
So let's return to the here and now, where you're reporting that Newcastle County is taking a first step toward fixing this building up. What is that step? What does it entail? And what kind of shape is the building in?
Well, since acquiring the property in 1976, the county had done very little to preserve the building. There was a repair effort in the late 1990s, but the house has been poorly maintained since then. And in fact, some of the repairs and improvements that were made then, pretty much shot by now. So right now, the county is seeking bids for what it's describing as exterior stabilization of the Ivyside farmhouse. And that means new windows, new roofing and flashing, making sure essentially that the main structural elements that hold the building together aren't going to fall down. And it also includes installing new electrical, water, and sewer connections. Work on the building's interior would come after that, but we really can't tell anything about its condition. I mean, even some of the people who are interested in occupying it have not been inside the building at all recently.
So what comes next is similar to what we saw by with the nearby Jester Farmhouse, an outside group stepping in to convert the space for a new use. So let's start with who's stepping in here and what can you tell us about them?
It's a group called the Delaware Africa Coalition, and they recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the county. Now, under this agreement, once the county takes care of this exterior stabilization work that we described, the coalition would then sign a 20-year lease with the county, and it would assume responsibility for restoring the interior and outfitting it to serve as a community recreation center and meeting place. Now, the Delaware Africa Coalition was formed in 2015. 2015 as a way of unifying people who have an African heritage. Now, you know, our society has a way of lumping together people and labeling them as, oh, they're black or they're African American. But their roots are actually from many different parts of Africa, and many of them may have reached Delaware from Africa or from the Caribbean or from Latin America. Now, the Delaware Africa Coalition sees itself as an entity that can help its members share their common heritage, that their roots in Africa, while celebrating the differences from the different parts of the world where they have come from. The coalition also believes that it has a role in helping newcomers to this country, people who might have grown up under different political systems, under military dictatorships, whatever, and help acclimate themselves to the workings of a more democratic society.
So how did the Delaware Africa Coalition get connected to this building as a potential home?
Well, the group had originally been meeting at the home of one of its founders, Kalichi Lawrence, but it realized that it needed its own place to call home if it wanted to continue to grow. Now, Kalichi Lawrence, who's pretty well connected in community activities and involved in a number of different organizations, tracked down Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer outside an event that they both attended. And they, at that time, they talked very briefly about the coalition, and they set up a longer meeting. Now, following this second meeting, Matt Meyer asked his staff to help the coalition identify some possible sites. Ivyside eventually rose to the top of the list. Now, the county didn't just agree to give the coalition the lease. There was a sort of competitive process. The county set out, asked for requests for proposals. Other community organizations submitted plans for the property. One of them was the fairly new Brandywine 100 Historical Society. But in any case, the coalition's plan was rated the best of the ones that the county received.
And what do we know about their preliminary plans for the building and its future use?
Well, you know, like most groups that are associated with a particular heritage, you can expect them to plan activities that build upon and reinforce that culture. You know, things like lessons and demonstrations of African cooking, teaching Swahili and some other languages that are fairly common in Africa, dancing and musical performances, things like that. But also, you can look for programming on social and political issues that are important to this group. Things like immigration, like citizenship, the status of relationships between the United States government and African nations, for example. Now, in addition to that, the agreement with the county calls for the coalition to open the building up to community groups, which means that civic associations and others, fraternal whatever groups in the area could be able to use the building for their meetings and other events as well.
So, as always, funding for projects like this, usually a key piece to making it happen. What are the plans for paying to convert this building once it's stabilized?
Well, you know, Ed, we know it's going to take probably more than $1 million or so for the county to do the exterior. It's not clear at this point how much it's going to cost to get the interior into usable shape and to add the features that the coalition would need for offices, for programming, and so on. However, Senator Chris Coons is pushing for a $500,000 preservation grant from the Historic Preservation Arm of the National Park Service. Now, that funding, if it's awarded, and this decision is likely later this year, can only be used for reconstruction, restoration, and preservation purposes. Now, beyond that, the coalition is going to have to be looking at the usual suspects for donations, local foundations, businesses, individual givers, that sort of thing.
So let's talk about the timetable for this project. What does that look like? Chester Farmhouse took years. Could the same be true here, or could this project maybe move a little bit faster?
Well, I guess, you know, the timetable here is pretty much to be determined. Bids for that exterior stabilization are due on the 20th of August. It's likely to be a month or so after that before the county will get around to awarding a contract, and that stabilization work is likely to take us, late next year anyhow. Then it's going to be up to the coalition to find a contractor to do the interior work. So the best case scenario here is that that's probably another year or so. So now we're already up to late 2026, early 2027. However, as you mentioned, the Jester Farmhouse project took more than 7 years from the time the county received a proposal from the Jester Group until the Art Center was able to open earlier in June. When nonprofits, especially newer nonprofits, have to raise large sums, it often takes longer than they anticipate. And contractors often uncover surprises when they're working on the restoration of buildings that are more than a century old. So if you want me to make a prediction, I'll say this project is going to be completed later rather than sooner.
So this does feel like another positive outcome, both for Ivyside Farmhouse and the surrounding Bechtel Park. Are there any potential potholes that need to be avoided, or is there genuine reason for optimism that this is going to work out?
Well, you know, I think we've just mentioned a couple of those potential potholes. Are there going to be any surprises in the restoration of the building, either the interior or the exterior? Will that $500,000 grant from the National Park Service come through, and how much will it cover? How much more funding will the coalition need to pay for the interior restoration, and will they be able to find it? You know, that being said, Newcastle County has let Ivyside languish for nearly 50 years, and it had tried unsuccessfully in the past to identify an individual or an organization that would be willing to come in and restore and manage the property. So what we've got now is definitely a positive sign. Now, a positive outcome in the long term is not a sure thing, but there are still plenty of good reasons to believe that the county and the Delaware Africa Coalition are going to be able to make this eventually work.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. His piece on new life for the Ivyside Farmhouse in Brandy 100 is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We take a closer look at what hurricane season could bring to the First State and how to prepare now. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Atlantic hurricane season officially began this month, and although Delaware has historically avoided direct hits, record-breaking warmth in the Atlantic Ocean and higher surface temperatures are increasing the likelihood of hurricanes and other major storms impacting the First State. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon recently spoke with Mike Lee, a National Weather Service meteorologist in Mount Holly, New Jersey, about the First State's hurricane forecast this year and how Delawareans can prepare.
So what is it about higher ocean and general surface temperatures that essentially fuel hurricanes and raise the odds of other major storms happening? How does that work? Can you walk us through that?
So hurricanes and tropical cyclones, really, they just feed off of the warm ocean water. And typically, if you want a hurricane or tropical cyclone to, you know, form and strengthen, you usually need ocean temperature water or sea surface temperature waters are at least 80 degrees Fahrenheit in order to help form and maintain its strength and even potentially get stronger. Warm ocean waters are one of the main ingredients that form hurricanes and tropical cyclones. Simply put, the warmer the waters are and the larger the area of warm water that is extended, the greater chance we will have to see a hurricane or tropical storm forming and even strengthening.
Well, dovetailing off of that then, is Delaware's coast getting warmer? And what else are we seeing on that score in surrounding regions along the coast?
Delaware's coast, certainly, we're seeing some warm temperatures off the coastline right now. One metric that we utilize to measure the warmth of water compared to what is typically normal is something called sea surface temperature anomalies. And right now, off the northeast coastline, including Delaware, sea surface temperature anomalies are about 3 to 4 degrees Celsius above average. So that's a decent amount. That's, you know, being fairly warm, you know, a nice indicator that those waters off the coastline are fairly warm. Right now, off the coast of Delaware, it's about 75 degrees, so, you know, Fahrenheit. So we're looking at, you know, some above average, temperatures for our waters. Across the North Atlantic as a whole, when we look at the entire North Atlantic basin, sea surface temperatures are near record warmth. Last year was a record-breaking year in terms of sea surface temperatures across the entire North Atlantic. And this year, we're on track to either meet that or potentially exceed it, depending on how the rest of the year goes. So we're already looking at very warm surface temperatures as a whole, and also warmer sea surface temperatures, you know, off the Northeast coastline.
In terms of these temperatures and the warming of our oceans, is this here to stay with us? Is this our new norm, unless, you know, barring humans doing something drastically different as far as climate and climate change goes, is this our new norm?
It certainly is possible. And here's the thing. Admittedly, we won't know for sure until we have an updated climatological baseline. Essentially, for instance, one of the metrics that we use looks at an average of sea surface temperatures from 1982 to 2011. And that's the average that we take, and that's what it's compared towards. Every year since 2012, the North Atlantic Basin has seen above average temperatures in terms of sea surface temperatures. And the last 2 years, this year included, has been near record warmth for those years. So it certainly is concerning and something that we have to watch out for. And in reality, with, you know, with climate change occurring, there are countless studies out there that show that, you know, our oceans are absorbing a lot of that additional heat and additional warming. And so that certainly is contributing to the higher sea surface temperatures.
So with Atlantic hurricane season already underway, what can we expect in Delaware this year? Does the weather we're seeing suggest anything about the coming months, the weather we're seeing right now? What can or are you able to forecast at this point?
Unfortunately, we really can't forecast too much in terms of direct impacts for Delaware. But in general, we are looking at a very high likelihood for an above average hurricane season. I believe the number that's being forecasted right now by the Climate Prediction Center is 85% chance of an above normal season. And that means more storms, more hurricanes, and really more chances for hurricanes to develop and then impact the U.S. coastline. Again, it's not necessarily a guarantee. It's impossible to predict this far out if Delaware will get hit or not. But the main point is that the dice are loaded right now for this season. There's a higher chance for more hurricanes to form based on all the different conditions, sea surface temperatures included, and also that La Nina pattern that we have. And typically La Nina patterns, it's very favorable for the Atlantic hurricanes to develop as a result.
There's a realistic chance, no matter how small, that Delaware faces something that resembles a major hurricane this year. Again, there's a chance there, not saying it'll happen, but even if there's a small chance there that something could happen, right?
Almost every single year, there's almost a chance, right? And, mm-hmm. and that's one thing I really want to emphasize is that, you know, above average season, below average season, those long-term forecasts are good to look at to get engaged as to, again, what's the probability of maybe seeing something impacting us. But again, it really only takes one, you know, storm to make it a bad year or an active year for your local area. And so we can have a very active hurricane season and nothing hits Delaware and then no one remembers it. But, you know, the larger scale of things, it's a very active season. But we can have, quote unquote, an inactive year on a large scale. But if one storm hits Delaware, people are going to remember it. People are going to, you know, recall it for years and years. And that would be considered a very active year. By scientific definition, a major hurricane is a Category 3 or higher on the Saffir-Simpson scale. And full disclosure, Delaware has not seen a quote-unquote major hurricane in its history. With that said, there's definitely been major impacts from other hurricanes, tropical storms, and tropical depressions in the past, despite not being that scientifically, you know, major hurricane. It's really important for folks in Delaware, as a result, to not focus too much on the category of that hurricane or tropical system, but more so focus on what is being forecasted for the impacts in your local town.
Anecdotally, when you hear or listen to discussions over hurricane forecasting in Delaware, this state gets mentioned, sure. And as you said, a legitimate hurricane, that Category 3 has never hit Delaware in its recorded history, but hurricanes and major storms seem to trend south away from Delaware and not north, you know, and Delaware never gets directly hit by a hurricane. So is it because of the state's geography, its climate, you know, something else? Why is Delaware rarely or just missing that direct hit by a hurricane or some, you know, or other major storms?
Yeah, the dry certainly plays into it a lot. Number one, despite warming ocean waters off the coast that we've seen the last couple of years, a lot of that those waters tend to stay below that 80-degree threshold that we're looking at. So those slightly colder waters tend to weaken tropical storms and tropical systems before they reach Delaware. Granted, if those warm waters get a little bit warmer and we actually hit that 80-degree threshold, then we start having some issues. In addition to that, this far north in the latitudes, we typically see a lot more other meteorological patterns and systems in that get in the way of a hurricane. So you've heard the jet stream, you've heard of different high pressure systems and such. There's a lot more activity in the northern latitudes during the peak hurricane season versus the southern latitudes. There's a lot more things that get in the way of a tropical system that either push it away or weaken it or otherwise manipulate a tropical system that move and shift systems away. That said, there's a couple of features that could potentially, push more feature, more hurricanes towards us. But generally speaking, the fact that we just have a lot of essentially traffic in the atmosphere up here, a lot of moving traffic, these hurricanes and these tropical systems get pushed away or they weaken. Again, another thing I want to touch upon is that even though Delaware doesn't get purely hit by those major hurricanes or even hurricanes in general, the greatest threat to Delaware is not a pure hurricane system, but perhaps a tropical storm, tropical depression, or even a system that has lost its quote-unquote tropical characteristics. You can still bring major impacts to Delaware, such as flooding, storm surge, and power outages, and anything of that such.
As we move forward, knowing that there's, and I'll use the Dumb and Dumber line here, so you're telling me there's a chance, but knowing that there's a chance of a significant storm, tropical storm or depression, or a hurricane here, what should Delawareans keep in mind to stay safe and, maybe more importantly, be prepared?
Yeah, I always recommend to folks to make your emergency plans now, write it down, share it with your family members, anyone that, and your close friends if you need to as well. Make sure you have a list of supplies that you need to purchase. We don't want you to be scrambling and trying to figure out, what you're supposed to do when there's a system that is within days of barreling down on you. If you have your supply list, if you have your emergency plan already written out and ready to go, you're going to be set. And then all you have to do is activate it, purchase your supplies, contact the places, the people that you need to contact, and know where to go in the event of a tropical system that's going to be impacting the area. If you're in a flood zone, if you're near the coastline, do you have somewhere that you can go and potentially evacuate to? Figure that out ahead of time and make sure you have that locked in with hurricane season already upon us. Also take into considerations, do you have any extra vulnerabilities, such as any physical disabilities that may limit movement? You may have to evacuate sooner than what the officials tell you, and you may need additional assistance to do that. Factor that into your plans as well. And then don't forget about your pets either. One of the more heartbreaking things that we see is that, people have to evacuate, they try to go to shelters, they have to figure out what to do with their pets as well. And so don't forget about them, make sure you have a plan for them as well. But yeah, preparedness can certainly ease a lot of concerns and a lot of anxieties when it comes to the potential for hurricane season to make an impact on us.
Thanks to National Weather Service meteorologist Mike Lee and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, we head to ChristianaCare to learn more about its first-in-the-state ultrasound treatment for people suffering from essential tremor and Parkinson's disease. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. ChristianaCare is the first healthcare provider in Delaware to offer an FDA-approved focused ultrasound treatment for people suffering from essential tremor and Parkinson's disease. Considered a better alternative for patients who aren't responding well to traditional methods, this new treatment called MR-guided focused ultrasound uses sound wave energy to remove areas of brain tissue that are the source of the tremor, the most well-known symptom of Parkinson's disease. This week, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry sat down with Dr. Justin Martello, director of Christiana Care's Parkinson's and Movement Disorders Program and Focused Ultrasound Program, to learn more about this ultrasound treatment.
Dr. Martello, before we get to the ultrasound treatment, let's unpack Parkinson's disease. I think most people have a surface-level understanding of what it is, but can you give us an overview of the disease, what causes it, and why it results in physical shaking and tremors?
Sure. So Parkinson's is a what we call a neurodegenerative condition, meaning that it does always kind of progress and get worse. Usually it happens later in life, late 50s, early 60s, although you know the age of onset can actually be quite a spectrum. And most patients who develop Parkinson's have tremor, but actually not everyone. About a third of people do not have tremors with their Parkinson's disease, but that still leaves two-thirds of them who do have it. And then it usually affects their overall ability to move in a kind of efficient way. And so their movements tend to get slower, stiffer. There's some weakness that can come with the disease and then eventually balance issues. But the tremors that they usually get is more what we say of a resting tremor. So their hands are kind of in their laps, they're not doing anything, and it starts to shake on their own versus the more common movement disorder that exists that the focus ultrasound is approved to treat as well, is called essential tremor. And so people tend to conflate all tremors to be the same thing versus where essential tremor, which is the most common, like I said, movement disorder that exists, affects people's hands, usually both hands together. Sometimes it's one hand more than the other. And usually when it's when you're using your hands, like holding something or doing something with your hands, like writing or doing fine motor movements, like screwing in a screwdriver or things like that. So, you know, that would be the difference. It's not a resting component. It's more of an what we call an action tremor or postural tremor with essential tremors. And that's kind of the difference between Parkinson's and essential tremor being mostly just the tremor in and of itself, whereas Parkinson's can involve other different organ systems of your body to cause other kind of disability symptoms other than just the tremors.
Outside of the ultrasound treatment we're talking about today, what do traditional treatments for essential tremor and Parkinson's disease look like?
So for the most part, we start with medications. They can be, you know, pretty dramatically helpful for tremor control for both conditions. But unfortunately for essential tremor specifically, and somewhat for Parkinson's too, there's not, you know, an infinite amount of options for medications. And so actually in the essential tremor world, we only really have 2 to 3 main options for tremor control. There are sometimes other medicines that can be helpful, but usually not dramatically. In the Parkinson's world, we have, you know, depending on how you count it, maybe 4 or 5 different options. But again, it's not infinite. And sometimes you're not a good candidate for some medications because of other medications you're taking or other diseases you have. And so it's really the medications. And then after that, you're looking at what we call more procedural options. And for both essential tremor and Parkinson's, there's really 2 main procedures that we talk about. One is called the deep brain stimulation procedure, or DBS. And that is indicated for both conditions. What it involves is actually drilling a hole in your head, usually both sides of your head, and inserting an electrode deep in your brain in order to stimulate the cells that are not really working correctly that are causing the tremors. And by sending an electrical stimulation, and this is connected with a wire and a battery pack underneath your skin, we can essentially program the device to stop the tremors and to help with some of the other symptoms of Parkinson's disease as well. And so, you know, obviously more invasive of a procedure, but it's nice because we can do it immediately on both sides of your body. And for both conditions, it does affect both sides of your body. And with this device, we can actually control other symptoms other than tremors, at least for people with Parkinson's. And it's programmable over time. So as the disease progresses, we can adjust it. Versus the other procedure, which is, again, the new one we have at Christiana Care, is called the MRI-guided focus ultrasound. This is a somewhat non-invasive way to essentially kill the cells that are causing the tremors. And so there's no cutting involved, and it's an outpatient procedure. And so the way it works is you're in an MRI machine, and that's how we know what area of your brain to target, because this tremor center is the same for everyone, or at least the location of it is. And what we can do is we can take 1,000 ultrasound waves, and if they all intersect in one area, it can essentially heat up that area of cells. And if we heat up the area of cells enough, we can actually cause them to essentially die and stop the tremors, because the cells are right now not working appropriately, causing the tremors. And so we can actually do that through without cutting into the skull. We kind of knew that this was something we could do because we used to do this procedure back in the 60s and 70s, way before I was born, to where we'd actually have to open up the skull, stick a probe down, burn the area, and close you up. And now we can do all of that without any cutting or drilling into the skull. And so it is an outpatient procedure. The patient has their tremors relieved the same day in an immediate time. They go home with dramatically less tremors. We only can do one side of the brain first. We can do the other side of the brain separated by 9 months, but they can come back for that. And it tends to be not only a well-tolerated procedure because it's non-invasive in the sense that there's no cutting, but what we can do is we can deliver a little bit of heat energy, but not enough to kill the cells, enough to kind of stun them. And so we're constantly going in and out of the machine saying, like, how are you feeling? You know, we sent a little bit of energy there. And if they still have the tremors or if they have any side effects, okay, maybe we're not in the right spot. We move over a little, no permanent damage is done. And then we can deliver a larger dose of energy to actually permanently kill the cells when we know we're in the right area with no side effects or with very little side effects. And so the only thing that we really can't test for while you're on the MRI table is your balance and your walking. And so that's what we tend to worry about the most as far as possible side effects. Usually any side effects that happen will happen right away. They usually resolve within days to weeks to a few months as the brain kind of heals. And then after that, there is some risk of permanent kind of side effects, mostly balance. We talk about between 10 to 13% of patients can have some balance issues. Sometimes people can have some residual numbness and tingling issues, but that's essentially it. Most of the time we can avoid them because we can see without causing any permanent damage real time what we're doing to their brain during the procedure.
Now, with this MR-guided ultrasound treatment, ChristianaCare's MR-guided ultrasound treatment, what are the benefits of going this route as opposed to some of the alternatives or traditional methods?
So I think the main differences essentially between this and DBS would be it being less invasive. So especially for older patients who maybe not are great surgical candidates for a number of reasons, or they're on blood thinners, or they just are diabetic or have other like medical conditions where a more invasive procedure would not be good for their bodies, this would be a much easier thing to go through. You know, a lot of patients just like the idea better that it's less invasive. But I will say, you know, as far as DBS goes, if you are a younger patient with tremors, let's say in your 50s or 60s, and you have, you know, hopefully another 20 or 30 years to live, we do have better evidence that DBS works for a longer period of time than the focused ultrasound. I mean, right now we have good published data that the ultrasound treatment works for about 3/4 of patients in a significant way at the 5-year mark. But, you know, the underlying disease still happens. And so more and more cells are involved. And so the tremor will eventually come back somewhat. And so the idea at that point is, what do you do? Do you do the focused ultrasound procedure again? Or maybe you go to DBS at that point, because you can do DBS after focused ultrasound, but you can't do vice versa. And then the other thing in Parkinson's, where you have other physical symptoms happening besides tremors, the DBS can be really good at treating other physical symptoms other than the tremors, versus the focused ultrasound, at least for right now, is only approved to treat the tremor as far as the symptom in Parkinson's. It is being looked at for other symptoms of Parkinson's, but not approved yet.
Now, many patients who've undergone this ultrasound treatment reportedly experience an immediate and significant reduction in tremors. So tell us more about the reception from patients thus far.
So I had this procedure, or I was exposed to it in my training fellowship now, you know, 8 years ago, 9 years ago. And it's still as dramatic as it was back then as it is now, where you can imagine patients living with these tremors for years and years of their life, needing to find ways around even holding a drink and bringing it up to their mouth, like not being able to drink coffee at all, just sipping it through a straw, not being able to, you know, brush their teeth without holding both hands together, not being able to sign their name, like all these things on a everyday, every minute basis, even little things you wouldn't think of, using your phone, being able to type on your phone, just the hardest little things that add up, obviously, over time, to go from that for years to years to very little to no tremors and the ability to do those things. I mean, it's usually very, you know, of an emotional kind of feeling for everyone in the room. I mean, you see what they're like going into the procedure and then immediately afterwards, and even during it, And it's really dramatic, and everyone's just, thrilled. The patients love it. They can't stop smiling and or crying, happy crying afterwards, and we all feel kind of just as emotional about it.
Now, ChristianaCare is also the first healthcare provider in Delaware to introduce this ultrasound treatment. But do we have an idea of how long this treatment has been around?
Yeah, in research, it's been around for at least 15 or 20 years. Like I said, there were some sites like where I trained at University of Maryland. We were one of the first sites. Us, University of Virginia, Binghamton Women's in Boston, were one of the first sites to have it. And again, they've been researching it since then. It was officially approved to treat essential tremors in 2016. So that's when the FDA approved it. But again, it was in research probably at least 10 years before that. So.
The MR-guided focus ultrasound treatment is covered by Medicare and most insurance plans, but how can we start a conversation with our doctor if we're interested?
Yes, it is covered under most insurance plans. So that's the really nice thing. And, if you are interested, so essential tremor tends to be kind of a bread and butter thing that many primary doctors and general neurologists can treat, at least start with medications, right? And have that discussion because you're not a candidate unless you fail at least one or two of the current available medications or it's contraindicated because of some other reason. And so as long as you've tried the medicines and they've either failed or you just can't tolerate them or whatever, then it's a good idea to refer to us. We have a movement disorder team here at ChristianaCare. There's a lot of different ways that they can refer to us. We actually have a website. If they just, Google search ChristianaCare Focus Ultrasound Program, we have a contact number for our Focus Ultrasound Coordinator, Melissa. We have an email address, and there's plenty of ways to for providers out there and patients to try and refer them to us to just confirm that they're a good candidate as well.
Thanks to ChristianaCare's Dr. Justin Martello and our Joe Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Art's Playlist and a look at plans to restore the Grand Opera House facade. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Roughly 50 years ago, the Grand Opera House in Wilmington received its first significant restoration. And this year, the Grand is undergoing another restoration and is redoing its facade. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel is joined by the Grand's Executive Director, Skip Pinella, Director of Sales and Marketing, Dan Palmieri, and Director of Operations, Julia Doherty, for a closer look at these restoration efforts.
Why don't we just keep saving it? Why don't we build a new building?
To build a building like this now would be extremely cost prohibitive. And the building itself has this wonderful theater that is acoustically perfect, that was built in 1871. The staff here looks at it role in two ways. One is obviously we bring a lot of different kind of music here, whether it be rock, classical, country. But we also see ourselves as stewards of this building, and we want to make sure that we leave it in better shape than it was when we got here. And if you walk down Market Street and you see all the new buildings that are trying to go up in terms of residential restaurants, the linchpin of Market Street is this building. It certainly defines a little bit about what Market Street is when you consider we have this building, we have the Baby Grand next door in a playhouse up the street. It makes a statement about the city. It makes a statement about who we are. And that's why, as you know, we're closing for 2 months. And one of the major projects we're going to be involved in is redoing the facade.
Dan, I want to ask you, it seems like a lot of people might say, well, couldn't you do isn't there something better about a new building? Or is it a little bit easier to put a building like this out to the community and to the world?
Of course, I think it's important to recognize how much history is here, and especially with our guests. We've found that when people come to the Grand, they fall in love with this place. not only the beautiful architecture and everything around them, the wonderful acoustics, but the people that are here, our volunteer corps. And of course, you know, they have a ton of history with their family, coming year after year to see the Nutcracker or any of the wonderful programming that we put on any number of our stages. So I think it's important that we honor that history. There is a wide variety of wonderful programming and arts entertainment that people can choose from. So we are so grateful that they choose to come to the Grand. In terms of when we're marketing, of course, we're marketing the fantastic shows, the world-class artists that grace our stages, but we really want to drive home the point that when you come to the Grand, you are taking part of history. You are joining in this wonderful line of guests that have come to enjoy art and culture here on our stages. And I think that's the most important part of what we can offer here at the Grand.
Julia, I want to talk a little bit about the facade. There was a little bit of planning involved in this. Can you give us an idea of kind of the timeline?
Well, it kind of came to the forefront of operations, a list of things to do. We got our historic windows on the Grand side of the building refurbished in 2018. And during that work, we saw a lot of the facade with the windows out. And over the next couple of years, we notated special spots that we saw major rust or decay in 2018. And then we kind of just kept an eye on it. And then between the pandemic year and I would say about 21, we noticed that there were some spots that are exponentially growing a lot faster than they actually should be. So it came to the forefront to restore the face of the Grand now before it has to be rebuilt. Because as of right now, it can just be fixed and there can be materials applied to those rust areas to make them stop spreading kind of like a cancer and put our face kind of fully back together.
It seems like we want to keep these around as long as we can. Are there discussions and possibilities for anything happening with those?
Oh, yes. Well, the Playhouse had major renovations completed in about 21. We had some major renovations for the inside of the Playhouse, generously donated by one of our longtime board members and supporters of the Grand. The couple donated a bunch of money to allow us to do that while we were closed for the pandemic. So that actually helped us a whole lot because we didn't have to, you know, schedule anything. So there's no major renovations planned for the Playhouse. But inside the compound that is the Grand and the Baby Grand, there are many things planned for like the next 5 years. We want to get the carpets replaced. We want to get everything kind of repainted. One another major renovation hopefully coming up in the next year would be the main elevator that services the Grand. That elevator was last fully refinished in 71, like the facade. And through preventative maintenance and things like that, we've been able to keep the old girl happy. But it's getting a little costly to repair now that some things are no longer in use widely, you know, so parts and labor are getting a little expensive. So we're hoping to save some money in the long term by getting that updated fully as well, hopefully within the next year.
As part of the project that we hopefully will be completed during July and August is the rigging on the Copeland Hall has to get redone. That hasn't been done since the 1970s. So that's going to be part of the project. As Julia articulated eloquently, the Playhouse was redone with the generosity of Mr. and Mrs. Copeland. They put over $1 million into the Playhouse 3 years ago to bring that back to its original luster as well. And so, again, going back to our stewardship, these are all things we have to do to keep these buildings the way they should be going forward. So they service the community for many years to come.
Artificial intelligence seems to offer an opportunity for that world that we love in film and two-dimensional and digital to kind of take over what we do. It seems to me there's an opportunity for live performance to come roaring back because you can believe what you're sitting in the room hearing and seeing and listening to.
Well, I agree 100%. I mean, just look at you know, we put, let's look, because it's right fresh in our mind, look at the Beach Boys. They've been around for, you know, when we were young. And yet, as much as everybody knows their music, as much as people have heard it over and over again, you know, we put them on the stage and we sell that show out. Now, there's only really one original Beach Boy, but people want to come and hear them live. They want to see them in person. And that's true with a lot of the acts that we bring here. People, you know, you can go, you know, we do a lot of comics here too, Lewis Black, Kathy Madigan, people like that. You can watch them on TV. You know, they're on TV from time to time. You can go to their website, you can go to YouTube, but it's not the same when you see them live with the interaction between the artist and the audience. And that's why it's so important to keep venues like this going strong, because if they disappear, that ability to see these live shows is not going to be around.
I think you do get AI at the Grand. Actual interaction.
There you go. I love
There
it.
is nothing that will ever
Sorry.
surpass the magic of live performance. We have some fantastic artists coming up. Dionne Warwick will be coming next season. Disney Junior is coming back. AJ Collier and the Band of Believers is doing a wonderful gospel show. Celtic Woman, Old Crow Medicine Show, and of course our wonderful Broadway and Wilmington series up at the Playhouse. These are experiences that you cannot recreate. There is a magic when you get into that room that you just have to feel it for yourself. And we are so lucky that we can do that, not only through the shows that we present and sell tickets to, but also through our community engagement activities and, of course, our education programs, where we bring students from local schools here to see these programs and programs especially designed and picked out to match the school's programming and education to really just highlight what these kids are learning and give them their first, some of them, their first experience in a theater. AI will not be able to do that.
You know, we're so close to the 4th of July. It's like the difference between watching fireworks on TV and seeing them in person. You can't replicate fireworks on TV. It doesn't work. However, if you know, you go to a facility and that has fireworks, it's very different. And I think that's the same thing with live performances. You can't replicate that live interaction between the audience and the artist. It's different every night, even though an artist will play the same set, you know, every place they go. As you know, every performance is different, every interaction is different. And it's that interaction between, as Danny just said, that interaction between the audience and the artist that makes these live performances so special. And it's why people keep coming. Our job is to make it easier and better for them to come.
Thanks to the Grand's Executive Director, Skip Pinella, Director of Sales and Marketing, Dan Palmieri, Director of Operations, Julia Daugherty, and R. Carl Lengel for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for a weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry and Carl Engel, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. The Green is taking a break for the July 4th holiday next week, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.